This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Bob Woodruff is on a book tour these days, something that would have been unthinkable a year ago. In January of 2006, Woodruff was at the apex of his career. He was the new co-anchor of ABC News. Then, just 56 days into that job, he was in Iraq covering the war when a roadside bomb went off close by. Its shrapnel and rocks shattered his skull, injured his brain, and put him in a coma for 5 weeks. When Bob Woodruff emerged from the coma, many words, the stock in his trade, eluded him. The longtime reporter couldn't remember states' names or the name of Britain's prime minister. He had to learn words anew at a kindergarten level with his twins of that age. Some words still do come slowly to Woodruff, but not to his wife Lee, who helped him through the ordeal. The Woodruffs have now written a book about the recovery process titled In an Instant, and they spoke about it recently at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco. It's that program we'll hear today on Word for Word. Bob Woodruff was trained as an attorney, but he quit practicing law to work in TV news. He was a national and international correspondent with ABC for 9 years, and then, in December 2005, he was tapped to be co-anchor of ABC World News. Lee Woodruff has worked as a freelance writer. As you'll hear, she is not bound by journalistic constraints as her husband is, and is more openly critical of the government for its actions regarding this war, in particular, the level of therapy available to those service personnel returning with brain trauma. The Woodruff's March 27th appearance at the Commonwealth Club was moderated by Dan Ashley, the evening news anchor at the local ABC affiliate in San Francisco.
Let's start with both of you just reflecting for a moment on what brought you to this spot tonight.
How much time do you have?
As much as you want, Lee, please.
You can call.
Okay. This has been more than a year since this happened, which kind of shocks me because so much of it feels like a distant memory, and so much of it feels like it was just yesterday. For anyone who's gone through any kind of crisis, and there are so many definitions to that word, it could be that phone call you get that your child's been in a car accident, or maybe it's a mammogram, a bad result, or a loved one who has cancer. Life changes from that moment on. And so many people have asked me, how did I survive? And I think that inside all of us, all of you, there is the strength to survive in the moment where you're being called on to be tested so strongly. And that comes from love. It comes from me, from being a parent and having to be strong for the children. And then also inside of myself, I kept this kernel of hope that that Bob would be different, that this would be okay, because I just wanted to believe that Bob would be well someday. And we're still a work in progress as a family. I can't believe he's here, and he's here so completely in terms of his personality and his cognitive abilities and his intelligence. Every now and then he messes up a word. We've had some really great examples. We had problems with a phone one day, and he screamed out, "When is that Viagra man coming?" And I said, you mean the Verizon man? We're in California, so this is a relevant joke, but there was a friend of his in high school, and he'd gone back home for a reunion. It was the first time that he went on a plane by himself since the injury, and I was sort of a nervous wreck. And he came back, and he had pictures, and he said, I was looking at Lori, and she looks a little different. I think she's had a breast explosion. And I said, all right, that works. I know what you mean. A boob job, maybe, is what you're reaching for.
At this, Bob, if you'd like to end the discussion here, that's fine.
Well, I will tell you, though, that obviously I have lost the job of being the anchor of ABC. But if you just accept these kinds of words as the official ones of America, then I'll go back.
I'll try to divide up our questions in certain areas, but let's start, I think, with probably what most people have on their minds in the interim here, how you're doing and how you've come to this point in terms of your recovery, Bob. And one question from the audience, how many hours a day do you spend in physical therapy? And what do you work on? And is your sight back to normal?
Well, I don't, you've probably seen some of the pieces that we've had on television. The documentary, for example, the hour that we ran, you saw how my kids, who were at that time 5-year-old twins, were teaching me the words of the English language, you know, which is pretty remarkable. I think I've finally at least come up to about the six-year-old level with my kids. That's what I've been doing. If I had tried to do this 6 or 7 months ago, I probably wouldn't be even able to speak to you right now. And I would think in that time, I think for the first 8 months or so after I finally woke up again, I went back to the doctors, the hospital, about 5 to 6 days a week to try to get that kind of rehabilitation. So that was, you know, coming back over time. I mean, some of this is not only doing work with the doctors and the nurses and others that are helping you, also it's just natural. Your brain starts to get some of these back. So, for example, in the beginning, I couldn't even remember a single name in the country, of any of the states in this country. I did not restudy all of them by memorizing a map. I was just, day after day, other names of the states, for example, pop back into my head.
Are you aware, Bob, of things coming back? I mean, is it something you're conscious of? Can you see improvement day to day?
Yeah, there's some days where I surprise myself when I come up with a word or two. I don't know, like I was just, I remember just studying something about asymmetrical wars, and that word I could actually say, asymmetrical wars, was pretty amazing. I couldn't say, for example, Tony Blair for I don't know how many months. I couldn't even name the head of England. But I could say, somehow, I could say Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. Now, why this works in your brain, right, I still don't know to this day, but it worked.
Lee, let me ask you. Bob talked about the difficulty of grasping for words and for searching his mind for memories. I mean, this is an incredibly educated, incredibly intelligent, articulate guy. That must have been hard to watch from your perspective. While it was frustrating for Bob, I'm sure, it must have been very painful to see a guy who really had everything on top of the world, not only in terms of his career, but as a put-together human being, and to go back to the basics. Must have been tough.
It was terrifying. You know, I had always looked to Bob as that buffer, as many of you probably do with your spouse or your partner. You've got this person to sort of spell off of. So, hey, what do you think about this? Or read this for me and tell me what you think. And I had lost that person for such a long time. And I remember one night lying in bed, and one of my biggest fears was taking back the financial control of the family, which I had so willingly abdicated when we got married and so happily abdicated. And all of a sudden, you know, the world of mortgages and online banking and all the stuff that I really didn't care a fig about fell back in my lap. And we were talking about how to sort of shore up our finances because I didn't know what the future would hold. I didn't know if he'd be able to work again. So we were talking about refinancing our mortgage. And he said to me in bed, what's a mortgage? And, you know, on the one hand, it's funny, but on the other hand, it was terrifying because I thought, I don't know what a mortgage is. I can't really give you a good definition. So I think we're both in really deep trouble. But it was those kinds of things where you lost the person who, I mean, you know, there's a funny line in the book where I say, I didn't marry Bob for his good looks. I married him for his brain. And it was really true that Bob was the smartest guy that I ever had met, and I thought that that would make for great marital fodder for a long life. And here was this person whose mind I admired so much, who was asking me simple questions or unable to come up with complex words, and it was very frightening.
But, you know, the doctors say that pretty much with the kind of traumatic brain injury which I've got, it's never returning to 100%.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What do you hope for in your case?
99.6.
How close are you to that point? Yeah. How close are you to that goal?
You know, I have no idea. It's, you know, it's got a long way to go.
It's hard to give percentages. You see percentages. People will say I'm 85% there, but there's no real scientific measure for how far somebody's come. And I think in your case, wouldn't you say the things that you still would like to see improve was his ability to grasp and come out with more complex words? Speed of reading and speed of writing. He can do all of these things. It's just that they're a little bit slower.
But I imagine it's like any other muscle. The more you do, the better you get at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think right. that's right. I mean, I was probably, 1/200th of my speed of reading in the beginning of all yeah. this. So if I try to read a book, read a newspaper, it would take me, just to read one paragraph, would take me about half an hour. And I would read one sentence, and by the time I got to the fifth word, I couldn't even remember what the first two words were. Yeah. So I couldn't even get through an entire sentence.
Did that anger you, frustrate you? What was the emotion?
I would say it's probably the most frustrating part of it was my inability to express myself, come up with the word mortgage, but also just to read and not be able to read as much as I did before. I mean, I was surrounded by my family, my kids, my wife, my families, my brothers, her sisters, all my friends, our neighborhood. That was absolutely amazing. It made me so happy, but I was in pain, and I was going through those kind of situations where I couldn't really do what I did before, and that was certainly the negative part.
Sure.
But I was surrounded by love, and that's what really saved me.
Physically, are you in any pain?
No. What's remarkable is, because what happened is when they cut off 14 centimeters of my skull, which exposed my brain, it was pushing against the skin on the outside. And I would just have so much pain from that and all over my other parts of my body. But after 4 months, they finally put this plastic back on there and fixed my helmet on my skull. And I remember before I got that fixed, if I just went there to sneeze, I would just know that something was going to kill me, and I would sneeze and it would just burst. I mean, it was just the most amazing pain. And they put the skull back on after those 4 months. And I had my first sneeze after that. I said, okay, here's the test. And I sneezed, and it was absolutely no pain.
Wow.
So almost all of it is gone. In fact, the physical aspects of this are remarkable, very little. It's all about words.
Here's an interesting question, because I know this happened literally in an instant, and you don't really remember much about it from that moment forward. Do you suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder?
No. I think there are two sort of underrepresented number of injuries in this war. PTSD is certainly one of them, and the other one is traumatic brain injury. These are all relatively greater numbers that are being reported, but I don't have PTSD. I don't have that kind of depression for some amazing reason. I don't know why, but I got knocked out so quickly. I was asleep for a lot of the pain, and I didn't really see any other violence around me. And maybe that has a reason for it. I've also been in wars before where I've seen people die. I've seen friends before killed. And I say sometimes you get, amongst the many, many soldiers and Marines in this war, sometimes they're 20 years old. Maybe this may be their first war, first time they've been in the kind of situation. And seeing anything like that makes them much more depressed, I think. Mm. Sometimes they've seen it before. I don't know the reason. Those are just suggestions that maybe it's possible.
And I was warned in the hospital that Bob would be. There's a moment I remember clearly. The neuropsychologist, who's one of the key people that sort of stays with the family, and she helped assess my children to see when they were ready to see their dad when he was in the coma. And I said, well, Bob will be fine. I don't think he'll have any PTSD because he's been in so many situations where he's seen many, many horrible things, from the war in Bosnia when he was uncovering the human graves to
Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia, okay, excuse me.
One for Bob.
Okay. And this was another name that ironically he could say. Do you want to just try it out, just to see how it feels?
What?
Who was the president? Yeah.
Milosevic?
You say the whole name.
Slobodan?
Oh, you're letting them down. It's too late
Milosevic.
At night. Milosevic. Yeah. All he would walk around the room going, Slobodan Milosevic. And I would think, okay, let's see, you can't say the word anchor, but you can say the word Slobodan Milosevic. At any rate, I was sure that he would be okay. And the neuropsychologist said, no, actually, trauma compounds itself. So if someone has seen a number of traumatic situations or been in them, they're more likely to have PTSD. So I was primed for Bob to be a real basket case in this area. And amazingly, he woke up just really feeling lucky to be alive.
Hmm. What about Bob when you see, and Lee, you as well, I suppose, when you see IED explosions on the news now or any sort of situation in Iraq, does that provoke a reaction in you other than the normal journalistic reaction? I mean, is it more personal in some way?
Well, it's not really a fear about it. I mean, certainly if someone gets hurt by an idea, I feel terrible about it. And again, that's part of the guilt that I've got, that I did make through this better than many others. I mean, I know a lot of military guys who have been injured, and some have come out a little bit better than me, and some have come out, you know, either a little worse or a lot worse. And I feel whenever somebody gets hurt over there because of IEDs, I also think about the number of IEDs have also changed the coverage of the war for us. Because in the beginning of this, from 2003 to 2004, the first four times I was there, we were able to pretty much travel around the country and go into the hotels and go into the restaurants and interview the people, the Iraqis on the streets. And as of 2004 on, it really became almost impossible to do that kind of reporting anymore, unless you're in the very north. But generally, all the way from Baghdad around that area to the south of the way down to Basra, you can't really do that anymore. And that certainly makes me very nervous about how we're going to report this.
What do you hope to accomplish by bringing to light the many who have suffered severe injuries in this war? And you did a terrific program, for those of you who didn't see it, and I know many of you did, on ABC. Why are you both here? What is it you're hoping to bring attention to?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. I think most people, I think everybody here understands that there's been a significant difference between what we thought in the beginning of this war compared to what it is now in terms of those that have been killed, which is over 3,000 people, and also those who have been injured. And you're seeing a lot more injured in this war compared to those who died compared to previous wars. When you got, for example, Vietnam, but it's 3-1 in terms of injury versus dead. Now you've got really more realistically more like 16-1. So you've got a lot of people coming back that need a lot of long-term help in the military that may need this, who knows, for a few days, weeks, but largely for years, decades, maybe the rest of their life. And that's certainly something that we want to change, because the other thing is we've got only 1.5 million soldiers and Marines in this war compared to Vietnam, where you had about 12 million. World War II, you had 16 million. And now you've got only about 1.5 million. So therefore, very few of us in this room really see that many military. And when they come back to this country, it's just really important that we somehow figure out to show people what's happening so that people can help, because I think a lot of Americans desperately want to do that and would do that if they just saw what more was happening.
Lee, do you want to comment on
Think, there was such a I stayed in a bubble for a long time, nursing Bob back to health, and the two most important things in my world, the only things in my world, were Bob and our children and the family around us, really. So I missed most of the media coverage. I didn't have a sense of what was going on out there about Bob. And when I finally did sort of realize what the kind of story it had been, and living in the Bethesda Naval Hospital with all of the other families, military families, for those 5 weeks, it seemed so disproportionate what was being covered about Bob to what the other families were going through. We were all going through the same thing. Not only that, but we were a privileged family because this had happened on Bob's job, so that ABC was picking up the tab. I didn't have to ever look at a piece of paperwork. If a bill came to me, I could send it to his employer. And moreover, they were flying our children down every weekend to see us and be with him. And I visited many a family who the wife was on maybe week four, even week five, and had the children home with mom in Texas or somewhere else as she sat by her husband's bed, waiting for him to be able to be moved to the next step of the facility. As Bob mentioned, too, a lot of these Marines and soldiers, because there is no draft and we're in a volunteer army, they come from very small towns, many from families without means, so that the towns that they're going home to after they get out of the acute care stage, their operations are all finished, they've done as much for them medically as they can do. The next phase is the rehab phase. And once again, through workers' comp, through Bob's company, we had the ability to choose where we wanted to go and what kind of care we wanted. And yet the military are stuck within the VA system. And so if you're going home to a small town in Texas and the closest facility is a small hospital somewhere in a smaller town, they're probably not going to have cognitive rehab, which for the brain injured, which is going to be the signature wound of this war, is already, is the critical part of this. And Bob touched on it a little bit. His physical therapy was done within weeks, but the cognitive therapy was the part that really laces your brain back together. That's the part that exercises the muscle that is your brain.
Lee Woodruff, who appeared recently at the Commonwealth Club of California with her husband, former ABC News anchor Bob Woodruff. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Now back to moderator Dan Ashley.
Lee, let me ask you this. How did you explain your injury, this is from the audience, and its effects to your young children, four kids, to see Dad hurt like that with no idea how it was going to end up must have been very difficult. What did you tell them?
Yeah, well, when I first found out he was injured, I just said, Dad, you know, Dad's been injured and we don't really have that much information. When he was in the coma, I think my daughter saw him the first weekend and my son saw him the second, only because he was out of town. And I didn't have to give a lot of explanation. The visual of Bob said it all, and it was disturbing. And it was dire, and I can only imagine years from now what my children's takeaway will be on that first vision of their dad. But I made a pact with myself that I would never lie to them, because I never wanted that to come back and hurt me later. So that if they asked me, you know, how will Dad be, I would honestly have to say, you know, I don't honestly know. But I could then switch to the positive a little bit and say, but the doctors feel positive about this. And then I would always tell them, which was true, in my heart of hearts, I believe that your dad's going to be okay. Now, there is no longer journey to recover, I believe, than a brain injury. It is years and years of slowly, painstakingly watching the brain knit itself back together again, hopefully with the best kind of rehab in the interim. I think that the neurons that are sheared off, because what happens in a blast or a car accident as well, is that the entire brain is shaken, so that all the millions of neurons that connect your brain are severed. So it's not only the focal point of the injury, which for Bob was in the speech and language area of his brain on the left temporal lobe. The blast of the bomb shattered his skull and drove shards of his skull into just the dura of his brain. It did not go into his brain. But there was scarring there from the swelling, like a bruise. And as the bruise shrunk down and down and down over time, the neurons grow a millimeter a month, and it's incredibly slow. And the children could watch their father getting better, but you know, a child is used to sort of, I get a boo-boo, I fall, I put a Band-Aid on, and it's better in 2 weeks. So I think this was excruciating for them. So we would talk regularly about what are sort of the milestones, and we would find milestones, things that Dad could do. But in a child's life, it must have seemed eternal, and still does. You know, we're still not there all the way.
You know, and a lot of, Lee didn't really tell me a lot of information about how bad I was right when I woke up, from that first moment that I finally, after 36 days, woke up and saw Lee. I'm sorry, but I didn't get you water. And when I woke up, I didn't know if I'd been asleep for a day. I didn't know if I was asleep for a year. And I never even asked the question, but Lena didn't tell me, and she didn't tell me how bad I was. In fact, for the first couple of days, I didn't even understand that my skull was cut away over here. They had a helmet on me, but I didn't really even ask about that. All I really cared about was seeing my wife and my kids and my friends and everybody that's coming over to see me. And I certainly hearing for the first time the stories of the fact that my little girls and my son came to visit me while I was still asleep, and it, you know, from that very moment, felt me terribly guilty about it. The fact that they sought me in that situation without knowing exactly what was going to happen to me. And my little daughter Nora tells a story,
It was the year anniversary, just this past January 29th, and I had made a pact with myself that I was going to just only do things for me that day. So I think I got a massage and I went for a swim and I agreed not to talk on the phone, but I must have had one phone conversation, I think with my sister, where I was telling her that, you know, even though it was just another day, that I believe honestly that the body has a memory, that the body understands when there's an anniversary somehow, because I was just blue and I was down and I was determined not to be. And so we were going to bed that night, And our twins were right beside me, and our little Nora started to cry. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Well, just thinking about Dad." And I thought, oh, you know, I tried to protect them from the anniversary. And I knew there were news stories done on it that day, and I talked to the older kids about it, but I was trying to insulate them. And I said, but Dad's doing great. He's getting better. What are you sad about? And she said, "Well, he's just different." And I said, "Well, what's different about Dad?" She said, "Well, he's got, you know, red stuff all over his face here, and his body used to be perfect," she said, "and now it's got all these scars on his back, and it's all cut away." And she said, "And his hair sticks up." And then my best one was, "And his head's an oval now, Mom." Which I don't really quite get, because I think they did a pretty good job. And she said, "And you know, and sometimes he doesn't have all the words." And I said, "I know he doesn't have all the words, but he's getting all the words, and he's getting better." And she said, "But you know what, Mom? I think this new dad loves me more." So that makes it all worth it. Well, maybe not all worth it. Hang on.
As a dad, comment on that.
I think if you want to feel the little marks in my head like this, you donate $10, I'll let you do it.
Let me ask you about being in the field. You've been to Iraq a number of times before you were hurt. I've never been to a war zone, but I've been in hurricanes and riots and other situations, tornado once or twice. And I know as a reporter, we have our cameras with us, and we all have sort of a cloak of invincibility sometimes, we think, which we know intellectually is not there, but somehow we think we're just witnessing, we won't get caught up in it. And I think there is sometimes a rush to it. When you were on that tank that day, did you have that sense of that journalistic invincibility, or did you know it was a chance that you were taking? Do you remember?
I don't think it was complete protection. Like nothing like this is never going to happen to me. I always assumed there's some possibility of some kind of injury, but not. I don't think anything close like this. And I didn't really think, you know, really for, you know, being that close to those who had killed until 2003, when my friend David Bloom was killed, which was, he was 12 miles just west of Baghdad. And I was about 12 miles just west of Baghdad when he died. And that was the first time I really lived through a situation where one of my closer friends was actually killed in a war like that. Now, obviously, I knew so many stories of it, and I know so many, but for some reason, it didn't really necessarily seem it was going to likely happen. So I kept going, you know, these places. And I've got a different feel about it now, there's no question about it, and I definitely have a wife who has told me that I can't go to Iraq anymore.
That's fair.
While it's a war. And I think she's saying Afghanistan, but I'm still trying to figure if that's definite or not.
That's a negotiation depending on the jewelry that I get for my 47th birthday. Yeah. You know, for me, Dan, it all changed with Daniel Pearl. And we were living in London at that time. Mm-hmm. And Bob had actually been in Afghanistan. He was covering the hunt for bin Laden. And he'd been gone probably a month. And he was coming back the next morning. And we were all so excited, especially me, because I was going to turn the children over to him and get a good sleep. And the phone rang at about 4 in the morning, and it was Bob, and he was in the Dubai airport or somewhere in the Middle East. And he said, "You know, I'm really sorry I'm not coming home." And I said, "You know, what happened now?" And he said, "Well, the Pakistani insurgents have threatened to kill all of the foreign journalists in Pakistan. And so they're sending me back to Karachi." And I thought, okay, that's great. You know, that's wonderful news. And I think what Daniel Pearl did, in combination with the internet, of course, was change the way reporters have gone from omniscient viewers, people that could even perhaps be used as a vehicle by the insurgents to get their story across, to now becoming targets. So that what's better than getting an interview than maybe actually capturing and killing one and putting it all over the internet so that the world can see how powerful they are. And that's really changed for me, I think, the relationship between journalist as just omniscient viewer.
And so, you know, consequently, really the way to go to places now is to go with the military guys now, because that's where the protection kind of is. There was a time in 2005 where I wanted to really go to Fallujah because there's a lot going on there, and there was a great increase in shots and fights going on there. And Lee finally, for the first time really in our married life, where she broke down into tears and said, please don't go there. And I did obey that at that time. So she was okay on the second time about me going over there.
Really?
Because we were going with the military, and we looked like we got some pretty decent protection, and we had like some of the best helmets and with the best body protections and that kind of thing. And I don't know, maybe we slipped it a little bit, but we really wanted to go. And part of my feeling for this all along is all these military guys also have to keep going. You know, while this war continues, they go. We need to be going. Somebody. It doesn't necessarily have to be me, but it has to be somebody. And I was the one who always liked it, and I always needed to do it, and I always wanted to do it, and I went. And Lee was okay with that one. And I think that has now just obviously changed, because there's also another issue, which is once you get a TBI, your brain is affected by an explosion like this, it's more of a danger. If one blows near you, even though it doesn't obviously injure you with the obvious ones, but those can actually be worse in your brain if you've already got one in the past.
So you're a little more vulnerable now.
You're more vulnerable to it. And that's what's happening also with some of the military guys there now. Ones that have been hit once and they go back in the fight again, they get hit again, then they get more vulnerable to get more in-depth.
We were down in L.A. and we were at a TV station. We met a colonel who was there, who was an older man, maybe in his early 60s. He'd been in 36 IED blasts.
Wow.
And had a hard time getting the military to recognize that anything was wrong, because he was physically fine on the outside, but he had major short-term memory problems. His wife was extremely concerned about him, because she, as the closest person to him, knew that there were huge things wrong and that he had many deficits. And because it's often a hidden wound, and people are called the walking wounded who have a traumatic brain injury or brain injury, there's no outside wound. So the assumption is, well, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you.
You know, I think that what you're doing through the documentary, through the book and the appearances, has certainly raised the awareness of the issues surrounding soldiers and Marines coming back so badly wounded. This member of the audience asked, do you think that the administration's efforts to minimize the visibility of casualties in the Iraq War have contributed to the current problems at the VA, or just treatment of veterans in general? Do you think there has not been enough attention paid to those who are so horribly injured?
Yes.
No question.
You got a big recruitment issue.
I think without question. I think that we just haven't done enough. I think part of it is, without question, that we expected a war that was not going to be like this in the beginning, and it takes sometimes time to step up the speed of helping what needed for this situation. But I think there was a little bit of, I don't know exactly who or exactly was not really talking publicly enough about some of the injured in this war. Some of them didn't know much about it. I think of it like we said before, there's even those us in this room. Some of us are journalists who didn't know enough about it, so we weren't necessarily reporting enough about it. Certainly those in government that did not know enough about it, that were really following it. There were probably some that didn't want to start throwing a lot of more money out to try to help this. And for whatever reason, that kind of connection, I think, was the reason.
Well, do you remember, there was she was a Seattle Times reporter who took the picture of the caskets on the plane and got in a lot of trouble for that. And in talking to some other members of the military in Washington, it's very clear that if you're going to start showing pictures of the wounded or stories about the wounded, you're going to have an issue recruiting a new generation of battalions. And in my point of view, I'm not the journalist, I'm just the wife, I think it was a very calculated move on our government's part. And the wounded that were shown, moreover, were largely the amputees. And I think it's interesting to learn that there are only about 600 amputees in this entire war. But the coverage up to this point, you would think that was the major wound of the war. And there's certainly an amputation is a horrible, horrible disease or horrible injury to have. But I think from a PR point of view, it was also fixable. You could show the beautiful room, Amputation Alley at Walter Reed, show all the high-tech prostheses that we had, and yes, we can patch these boys up and we can fix them and we can make them almost good as new. You cannot do that with a head injury. The numbers are so far greater. It was understood so late in the game. And I think that it was the fact that somebody could be impaired for life, that somebody's personality could be vastly different, that somebody could, as one, as a woman who works for the Semper Fi with the brain injured Marines told me, one of the wives who was married to a Marine, and they were high school sweethearts, she had, and her children had to be taken about 6 months ago to a safe house because her husband, who had come home with a brain injury, had tried to strangle her in her sleep for the third time. And there are anger issues with brain injuries, frustration, and huge personality differences. And those can't be swept under the rug. Those aren't pretty to look at.
Lee Woodruff, wife of former ABC News anchor Bob Woodruff. The Woodruffs appeared together March 27th at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Now back to Bay Area television news anchor Dan Ashley, who served as moderator.
Interesting question from the audience. And why don't you both answer it, and Lee, maybe you first. If it's quite provocative. If you could have a candid conversation with President Bush, what would you say?
Well, this part got snipped out of the book.
This is your chance, Lee.
Don't think about all this. I necessarily believe anything that Lee says, but go ahead.
Oh, here comes the journalist with a disclaimer. Yeah. When we were in Washington, it was our children's February break, school break, and so ABC was very sweet in trying to figure out things I could do with all four kids, and so one of the things was a White House tour. And Martha Raddatz, who covers the White House, who's a friend of ours, met us at the gate and took us in, and we, went in and did the whole kind of West Wing thing and met with everybody. And Bush was out on a fundraising event in the Midwest. And so we went back to the press room, which is really sort of a bunch of little cubicles, if anybody's ever been back there. Not very impressive. And I sort of forgot for a minute that we'd been living in this fog with no one being able to see us or have access to us, which is what I had done. I had dropped a veil around us because the situation was so bad, and everybody was so eager to know what was happening with Bob, but we had no idea how it was going to turn out. He was still in his coma. So I went into the bullpen, and I said, are the ABC guys here at all? I want to say hi, because Bob and I had lived in Washington, and I wanted to say hi to the cameramen and the producers. And they said, no, they're out on the lawn. And I said, okay, well, can you tell them Lee Woodruff said hi. And all of a sudden, three reporters popped their heads up from their desk and said, Lee Woodruff, are you married to Bob Woodruff? And I thought, oh, no. So I started running. And they ran after me. And they were asking questions about Bob. And I finally turned to them, and there must have been something in my eyes where they said, where they thought to themselves, you know what, if this was my wife, this is not how I would want her to be hunted down. So they immediately switched gears and said, why don't you come outside? The president's about to land, and your kids can watch the helicopter come down. And I thought, okay, so we went out on the lawn, and the helicopter landed on the South Lawn, which is actually truly an amazing sight. No matter what you think of our administration, it's a pretty amazing sight to watch the big gold and blue bird come down on its mark. And just as we were going to sort of turn the person we were with said, can you wait a little bit because President Bush knows that you're here and he would like to meet with you. And I thought, oh, cripes. I thought, what am I going to say to him? Because I'm really pissed off right now. If he hadn't decided to avenge his father, my husband might not be lying in a coma right now. And that was really difficult. I was the last person to walk in the room. We had another family friend, set of friends with us. My children were in Target light-up sneakers that no longer lit up. Their hair was in a rat's nest. And the other family we were with were in beautiful little kilts, and their blonde hair was all pulled back in ponytails. So I felt like I felt pretty low on the motherhood totem pole at that moment. And I have to say that he was gracious, and he had tears in his eyes, and there were so many things I wanted to say to him, but Bob had interviewed him before and had met him, and he seemed genuinely concerned about Bob. And I thought, this is not the moment to give him a groin kick, although I was really tempted. Now, one last thing, because I'm drawing this story out way too long, but I used to walk into Bethesda Naval. I had gone shopping 2 weeks before Bob was injured to this fancy, not fancy, it's this discount, like Filene's Basement place. And for some reason was drawn to a black T-shirt with a giant gold bling peace sign on it. And I bought this shirt, and when I was packing to see Bob in Launchtool, I packed this shirt, and I wore this shirt as often as it was clean, and I wore it to the hospital every day, and the doctors, who thought I was kind of a nut anyway, I would walk in and say, "World peace, inner peace, this is what it stands for." And they would all say, amazingly, "I have to tell you, Lee, we support you so much, we are not for this war." And so the Secretary of the Navy came by one day with his leather jacket on, and I had my peace shirt on proudly, and he was kind of patting my back, and I had the curtain closed. I was not about to let him see Bob because there was a lot of curiosity about sort of dignitaries coming by to see Bob. And he was kind of giving me the spiel, and I said, "You know, when you see our president, will you ask him to please end the war?" And you could see his entourage with all their earpieces kind of lunge forward like, "I can't believe she just said that." And a couple of dentures dropped out on the floor at that very moment, I think. And he had a very quick answer for me, because I realized that he probably had given this answer to all of his grandchildren. He said, "I got to tell you, little lady, we didn't start this war." And he said, I can never get the sports analogy right, but it was something about not wanting your own guys on your own 50-yard line or something, basically saying that if we weren't there, they would be here. And I thought, you know, that's a tough pill for me to swallow, and I'm not biting down on that one. And I kind of took my sweater off a little bit so he could see the peace shirt, and I told him to have a great day, and I left it at that. But those were my two brushes with the administration. I tried to hold my own.
I think we know what the members of the audience would say if they had a conversation.
This is San Francisco. We love your politics.
What would you say, Bob, if you had that conversation?
Well, I've had lots of talks about it.
Bob,
there's no
is
question. I've had a lot of talks with Lee
night.
About it. We don't always agree on everything. There's no
You're
question
gonna see
about
him
it.
Tomorrow night.
What's that?
You're going to see him tomorrow
night.
All right, night. So you better have an answer.
But here's I mean, obviously, I think we all would hope to have a great success in this war right now. I think it's just, I think what we've all learned this over the last several years now, that's very difficult that ever happens. One of the things that always kind of astounded me about the war from the very beginning was that what we're really going to be possibly accomplish in this. I mean, it was one thing to look back at the previous wars that we did cover, that we saw, like Yugoslavia, for example, where that was really one with very few injuries in the war. We're really much dropping the bombs from about 20,000 feet. In a country would then ultimately split up into multiple countries because you couldn't have all those that fight each other all in one country, so they split up into separate countries from Bosnia all the way down to Kosovo, et cetera. So that was a different one, and that certainly looked like that was a great successful war that we were in then, but it ended up in a very different situation. To not really understand in advance what was going to happen between the Shiites and the Sunnis, I think, was still kind of astounding that we didn't really look forward to that. I think so many people, I mean, even till over years past, even some of the smartest people in the government still didn't really know the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and that there would be that kind of fire. All you do is look back to Israel. I mean, I'm sorry.
Jordan?
No. Just west of England.
Ireland.
Thank you very much. There you go. There's my brain. I see all these things. I know everything. I can't come up with the words. I mean, you just look at Ireland. You saw Christians fighting against Christians for decades. You know, to think that there would be Muslims fighting against Muslims was a good possibility in this situation, too. That certainly was not really seen well enough, deeply enough, as we probably should have. Who knows? The thing that we don't know about the war is, has it prevented other kind of explosions and attacks in this country for all of these months, of all these years? Is that possible? Is that something that's being accomplished? We really honestly don't know the answer to that. And that is probably the one positive aspect of the war, if in fact that is something that caused that, which we don't know yet. And Lee will never look at that one, that's for sure.
He's giving you the neutral answer, guys. You're never going to get the real answer out of him.
As we begin to wind down, let me ask a couple of questions, going back a little bit to your ordeal of the last year. Tell the story again, Lee, because it's a great story, and I know you've told it a few times, and if folks won't mind hearing it again, and those who haven't heard it will love it. When you walk into the room and Bob is finally awake, and Bob, you also have a good tale about that as well, but what was that like after all those months?
Well, the day before had been probably the lowest day, the day before Bob woke up, because they'd really been sort of talking to me about it was maybe time to think about a nursing home, because Bob was not following commands. He wasn't able to squeeze somebody's hand when a doctor would say, squeeze my hand. And I went to bed that night thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't live apart from the kids anymore. It had been 5 weeks. And I went to bed that night thinking, Bob, you've got to do this. Is up to you now. And I walked in the next morning. And it was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and Bob was sitting up in bed. His eyes were completely connected to his soul. He was no longer sort of this dazed, you know, out of it, comatose person. And he just looked at me and he said, sweetie, where have you been? Just like that. And it was just, of course, this amazing feeling of, you know, this has been a miracle. I can't believe, because he was not supposed to wake up that way. People wake up in degrees. There's sort of a gradual awakening, typically with coming out of a comatose state like that, where you're becoming just more responsive. And he certainly had some of that. He had croaked a word here and there, so we figured he could talk, which had been one of the major concerns because of the rock that had passed all the way through his throat. But the suddenness of the waking up was breathtaking.
Yeah, I think when you think about that stone, that rock going all the way through to my artery over here, 1 millimeter away from it to this day, I don't know why. I mean, I can still feel rocks inside on my nose right here, which passed right in front of my eyeball. It didn't go through that. There's ones that smashed my shoulder in the back, and somehow it hit that bones. It didn't keep going and go through my heart. The other ones that went through my neck down here didn't, you know, cut off my tongue, and just barely missed those too. I mean, all of these together, I mean, to this day, I just don't really understand why, but it happened, and there's probably a much more of a 99% chance I wouldn't be here right now.
You know, Bob was sort of making a joke earlier about his head, but we've created the Bob Woodruff Family Fund, which is an organization made up of family members right now and board members from the rehab world, the military world, the civilian world. And we're not reinventing any wheels. We are using the funds, taking a close look with recommendations from people in the field at what organizations on the ground are helping the military with rehab, with wounded soldiers, and also with integrating into the community. So lying in bed the other night with Bob, I actually found a rock, a new one, in his earlobe, because they keep working their way to the surface and coming out. So for a $10 donation to the fund, you can touch that rock as you pass through the line. I will show you where it is. $15 for the crease in the back of his head.
Bob, I think you're being sold cheap. I think we can get $50 or $100 for that. Easy.
I have a pretty funny wife, don't I?
And I would say a very tough and resilient wife. How important has she been in keeping your family together during this time?
If you read the book, you see that her name was the general during all of this. I mean, she really absolutely took control. And you know, my kids somehow got through this without being completely destroyed by it, and my friends too. I mean, she has just been, I don't know, I think I love her even more than I did before, and it was pretty damn much before.
Lee, how has you? I'm sure there were so many dark days where you didn't know where your life was going to go. How much stronger is your bond now, and how much more do you know about yourself having gone through this?
You know, I found out a lot about myself when David Bloom died, and Melanie, who is my best friend, I became that person for her that had to sort of do everything, you know, figure out when the last paycheck ends and get the little patent leather shoes for the girls for the funeral and take all the phone calls. So I found a strength then that I hoped I wouldn't need again, but I guess I've about weathered some of the worst that you can as a wife. So I hope that I've had my lumps. But I guess we're all survivors. Bishop Tutu has a saying that suffering is a part of the human condition, and you can really take it two ways. It can embitter you or it can embolden you. And I think we all make a choice in that moment. I don't think any one of us wants to be bitter. So I think we move in the other direction.
And Bob, let me ask you, because to reach the position of anchor at World News Tonight, or World News, it's an all-consuming profession. And just to get there, it has to be all-consuming in many respects. What have you learned about yourself, about your priorities, about what you want the rest of your life to be about through this incident?
Well, I think one thing is for sure, which is no matter what job that you have, as long as you've got those around you that you care about, you are relatively happier than if you did not have that around you. So in that sense, having the job does not matter. You know, I got into this work because I like to be a journalist and I like to travel around. I like to see things and I like to explain things and teach things. Anchoring was certainly one way to do it, and the way that we'd set it up with where we could also do a great deal of travel, even as an anchor, with two of us at least anchoring. But going back and doing the journalist again, if I get back on the route around this country and see more things happening, and even around this world, I'd be pretty damn lucky.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give Lee and Bob Woodruff a wonderful hand.
Dan Ashley, a television news anchor in the San Francisco Bay Area, closing out a recent discussion with former ABC News anchor Bob Woodruff and his wife, Lee. The Woodruff's new book is In an Instant, and it recounts Bob Woodruff's ongoing recovery from the brain injury he suffered during a 2006 roadside bomb attack in Iraq. Bob Woodruff also made a documentary about what happened to him to shed light on the brain trauma suffered by 10 to 20% of returning U.S. service personnel. It is, the Woodruffs say, the signature injury in this war. If you missed part of today's program with Bob and Lee Woodruff, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may visit our website, wordforword.org. There, you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and also listen to any of our previous programs, among them sessions with White House Press Secretary Tony Snow, writer Norman Mailer, and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And we had help this week from Mike Osborne. American Public Media.